Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. Would you believe that there is no fiscal crisis in the U.S. government? Would you believe it if a highly qualified, well-regarded economist made that assertion and proved it and explained that there is no fiscal crisis, rather there is an unemployment crisis, and that there is a solution, and the solution is to tax the banks. Stay tuned. I am delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Robert Polin. He is far and away the economist that has been most useful to me as an activist, an author and an expert and an expert witness on the question of living wages in our cities, the author of incredibly useful and endlessly cited studies on the advantages of military versus domestic spending, as well as terrific analysis on the fiscal mess we're in and how we got into it. Robert Polin is a professor of economics and co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and he has a book out called Back to Full Employment, which you can find also at a website, backtofullemployment.org. Robert Polin, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thanks so much, and what an introduction. I'll never live up to that.
I'm sure you can. We don't have to talk about every subject. We won't have time, but you wrote an article recently called A Modest Proposal for Jacob Lew. Acknowledge three simple facts about U.S. fiscal reality. First of all, for any listeners who haven't heard yet, who is Jacob Lew?
Jacob Lew was nominated by President Obama to be the Treasury Secretary for the second term of the Obama administration.
And his background recommends him for that? How?
He is a product of the kind of Washington Wall Street treadmill. He worked, I believe it was Citibank. Before that, he was budget director under Clinton, and then after he left Citibank to work again with the Obama administration, he was chief of staff, I think is to date chief of staff for Obama, and will be moving from that position into the Treasury, assuming his nomination is endorsed by the Senate.
And he supported the creation of NAFTA. He supported the deregulation of the banks.
On and on. He's very much in the mold of, again, I don't want to, you know, come up with obscure names for your listeners, but Robert Rubin, who was had been the head of Goldman Sachs before he became the head of President Clinton's first national economic advisor, and then moved in to become Treasury Secretary under Clinton. And he had a group around him, Rubin did, including Larry Summers, who was the Wunderkind professor at Harvard, and very smart and knows how smart he is and always finds clever arguments to support neoliberalism, deregulation of the financial markets, and then Timothy Geithner, who was Treasury Secretary in the first 4 years of Obama's, and Summers was the chief economic advisor to Obama. So they're all pretty much in the same group of people, Robert Rubin, Larry Summers, Timothy Geithner, and Jacob Lew.
So change you're having a hard time believing in, I take it. I was going to say, what are the three facts that Jacob Lew needs to acknowledge?
I thought let's start with some really simple things and not get into really heavy arguments as to how much we should tax rich people more, or to defend the fact that 47% of the people aren't truly freeloaders. I'd be very happy to engage in those discussions. But I thought, let's start with the simplest things, and if he acknowledged those simple things, that itself would transform the debate on the fiscal cliff, the budget deficit, austerity, on and on. Fact number one, We are not in a fiscal crisis. I say this a lot, and sometimes people think I'm absolutely out of my mind. And so let's just stick with the most basic data. By a fiscal crisis, by any common sense definition, means that the government or whoever is in this crisis is having a hard time paying its bills, can't cover its payments next month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months. And I think that's a reasonable definition of Greece. But in the case of the U.S., the actual amount that the government is paying out now and will be paying out in the near future in interest payments relative to our entire budget, fiscal budget, the federal government's budget, is actually at a historic low, not a historic high. We're paying out around 7.7% of the entire government budget in interest payments. By comparison, under Ronald Reagan, that number went up to about 19%. Under the full 8 years of Reagan and toss in the 4 more years of Bush number one, it was more like 16%. So we're paying half of what we paid back then. So how are we in a fiscal crisis? We can cover our interest payments easily. Now, why? That gets me to fact number two, which is that the U.S. government can borrow at near zero interest rates on the global market. So whatever else is wrong, screwed up, and there are a lot of things screwed up about our financial system, lenders are falling over themselves, continue to give money, to lend money to the U.S. government because they see it as a safe place to park money. And therefore, the U.S. government is able to borrow at less than 1% on even long-term treasury bonds. So that's fact number two. Everybody knows this.
Let's stop with fact number one and two. It seems to me that everyone who claims we're in a fiscal crisis, namely our televisions, they're not disputing that statistic, but using different ones. Perhaps the level of debt, the level of deficit, the absolute size of interest payments or of debt payments, or the approach of an arbitrarily set debt ceiling, or the ending of a continuing resolution. Why is it the relative size of interest payments to budget that is the determining factor here?
Well, let's just think about it in terms of a simple household situation. Let's say your household income is $100,000 a year. And so it matters a whole lot if you have to pay interest, if you have to pay $7,700 per year versus $19,000 per year. That's going to make a huge difference as to your capacity to cover that debt. And that's what the situation that the U.S. government is in. Under Ronald Reagan, we were paying like $16,000 a year on average, up to about $19,000 per $100,000 to cover debt, and now we're paying $7,700. So where is the crisis there? There isn't one. Now, that gets to fact number three. It is true that the U.S. fiscal deficit is historically large. It's true, and I don't deny it. Again, these are simple facts. The U.S. fiscal deficit shot up as a result of the recession, the Wall Street crash and recession. It had averaged about 2% of U.S. GDP historically. It shot up to 10% in 2009 to counteract the recession. It's now down to about 8.5% of GDP, so it's still historically high. We should be concerned about it as a second-order problem, not as the first-order problem, as a second-order problem. And part of the reason why it's only a second-order problem or a third-order problem is precisely that the government can borrow for next to nothing. So let's keep borrowing it next to nothing to get out of the recession. Once we get out of the recession and people have jobs, the deficit will come down because when people have jobs, that means they pay more income tax and more sales tax.
So the deficit, while not the problem it's made out to be, is caused by the recent recession. Was it also not caused in some significant part by tax cuts for very wealthy people and corporations and by very expensive military operations?
Oh, yes, of course. But let's just say, and that's true, but let's just say that before the recession in 2007, when those tax cuts were still in place and the military budget was not all that different than it is now, we still only had a deficit of around 2% of GDP. So the crisis with the fiscal deficit is almost entirely a crisis born out of the Wall Street crash leading to the recession. So that means that once we get jobs going again and people have incomes, yeah, we do have to address military spending. Rich people need to pay more taxes. And, yeah, we can't keep giving so much money over to the health insurance companies and the pharmaceuticals. And those are the things that are creating long-term problems with our fiscal situation. But in the short term, the real issue is getting out of the recession.
We're speaking with Robert Polin, and you can learn more at backtofullemployment.org, which brings me to the question, if we want to lower unemployment, how do we do it?
The very first thing to do is to say that's the real problem. So the fact that we're just talking about it right now, hopefully is helping a little bit to focus our economic policy debates where it needs to be. As long as we keep talking about the deficit as the overarching problem, as the crisis, we're going backwards. We're going towards austerity when what we really need to do is expand job opportunities. So how do we expand job opportunities? Well, the problem remains that the private business and private households are not in a situation to increase their spending a lot. There's a lot of debt that they gathered over the prior to the recession, and they're still having to pay that down. So it's imperative that the government at all levels, state, local, and federal, keep maintaining its spending level. So that does mean increasing the fiscal deficit for now. Now, I know that's not going to happen. That should happen. We should be spending to keep teachers on their job, keep nurses in their jobs, keep public safety workers in their jobs, invest in infrastructure, invest in the green economy, extend unemployment benefits. All of those things should be priority number one. They're not going to be, unfortunately. But that's where we should start. Now, my plan B, given that that's not going to happen, is that the commercial banks in the country are sitting on $1.5 trillion in cash hoards. That's about 10% of the entire U.S. GDP sitting there in cash. So how do we move that money where it belongs, which is into the hands of small businesses, lending them at affordable rates, so that they can get back on their feet, they can expand their operations and hire people? I think the way to start there is to tax the banks. The banks are getting money for free. The banks got bailed out, and then on top of that, the Federal Reserve has set the interest rate at which banks can borrow at near zero. So they're getting free money, and they're piling up these cash hoards. So we should start taxing that, saying that, look, you do need to have a cash reserve to be stable, to be prudent, but this is way, 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 way in excess of what's necessary. So we're going to shift incentives on you, and we're going to tax you until you start pushing the money out into the economy.
Would you tax financial transactions, as some people have labeled a Robin Hood tax?
Absolutely.
But what you're talking about is something else.
That's something else, but I've been in favor of the financial transaction tax for 20 years. And it was only due to the brilliant work on this of the National Nurses United, the Nurses Union, that mobilized people throughout the country and indeed throughout the world in support of taxing Wall Street transactions. Now, let me just say something quickly on that. One of the arguments that conservatives make about our tax system is you don't want to raise tax rates, but you want to so-called, quote, broaden the base. Broaden the base means tax things that are right now untaxed. Now, the biggest area by far of the economy that is untaxed is financial transactions. So it's a conservative argument. Broaden the base. Tax all financial transactions at a low rate, just like we tax all sales of consumer goods and business goods now. I mean, if I go down the street and buy myself a cup of coffee at Starbucks, it's taxed. If I go buy something useful like a bicycle, it's taxed. If we trade on financial you and I decide to trade on my stocks and you want to buy them and I'm going to sell them, no tax whatsoever. Why not? It should be taxed.
But you also, I take it, would like to see the big banks taxed for hoarding giant piles
That's
of wealth.
Right. We can call that the bank hoard tax. Yeah.
which
I wish I could get some, like the National Nurses Union that's been so instrumental in getting people to think about the financial transaction tax to also talk about this bank hoarding tax.
I think there are 400 billionaires or so, and maybe some multimillionaires who I wouldn't mind seeing taxed a little bit as individuals as well.
That's right. That's also important. Here's one amazing statistic. Coming out of the recession in 2010, when the economy started growing, albeit weakly, but the percentage of total income gain that went to the top 1% in 2010 was 93%. Of all the economy's income gains coming out of the recession, 93% went to the top 1%. That's how skewed our economy is. And yes, the taxes on wealthy people need to go up.
It's incredibly perverse, it sounds that the taxing of the hoarding of wealth by banks seems like an excellent idea to me, which I certainly will mention to the National Nurses.
They're good friends of mine, I should say. The blog that you mentioned that we have called backtofullemployment.org is actually sponsored by the National Nurses Union, full disclosure. So they're good friends, but I would love to see them engage with this as well and other people, because this is a way to mobilize this incredible amount of money. 10% of U.S. GDP is sitting there at the banks doing nothing, and the banks got the money for free.
The other option, as we're operating under the umbrella of this supposed need to deal with the deficit, other than taxing those who have too much money, is of course to cut some of the spending where it's not needed and move it somewhere more useful. And I've long benefited from, and I've seen cited thousands of times by peace organizations, a paper that you co-authored called U.S. Employment Effects of Military and Domestic Spending Priorities, which made, I thought, a very powerful case for moving some of the money, converting, retraining, retooling, moving war industries to civilian industries. Can you briefly summarize the findings?
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. I'm glad to hear that it was useful. You know, I don't see these thousands of sites, so it's nice to hear. I mean, I've kind of seen a few, but some of the more interesting were the ones from the lobbying organization for the military-industrial complex, who called me everything under the sun, nasty.
Let me tell you that last January, maybe it's two Januaries ago now, when it was 50 years since Eisenhower used that phrase, we had a conference here in Virginia and produced a book with the papers from the conference called The Military-Industrial Complex at 50, at least a half dozen of which cite that study of yours.
I'd love to see your book. That paper makes a very simple point. Oh, and I was going to say that the lobbyist that attacked, literally, you know, basically called me some academic idiot who doesn't understand the real world, and fine, say what you wish. They did not criticize my actual numbers, and they didn't criticize my methodology. No doubt they would have been very happy to do so if they found something wrong with it, and they didn't. They just called me names. Now, the point is that what we say in that study, the real point is that contrary to the idea that's always out there that spending on the military is a great source of job creation, what we found from U.S. government statistics is that the military, spend $1 million in the military and you'll create on average about 11 jobs per $1 million of spending. If you put that same money into infrastructure or the green economy, you get about 17 jobs, about 50% more jobs per dollar of expenditure. If you put it into education, you get 27 jobs per $1 million of spending. That is 2.5 times more than the military. 2.5 times more to defend our educational system and to build up our our national security in a rational way through education and investing in clean energy, than you get by holding the money in the military.
So the trick, obviously, is how to do the process, because people have military and weapons jobs and would lose them if they were taken away, as every Congress mm-hmm. member learns every day from the corporations that manufacture the weapons in bits and pieces in their districts.
That's right.
How do we get from here to there?
Well, I think that the military have been brilliant in giving something to every single congressional district in the United States. So, yes, there are people employed in every single congressional district in the United States through the military budget. It couldn't be otherwise that if the military budget is $700 billion, you are going to employ a lot of people by spending $700 billion. But the main point is you get more by spending the same money elsewhere. Now, yes, there's a transition. So the transition really doesn't have to be thought of as being all that hard, because all we have to do is spend more money in education. We already have a very well-developed educational infrastructure. So the idea of, say, cutting 25% of the military and putting it into education and infrastructure and the green economy, we already have the infrastructure available to start spending on the green economy, to invest in renewable energy and energy efficiency. So there will be jobs. In fact, there'll be a lot more jobs available through that kind of transition. We do have to be sensitive on the transition issues, that some people would lose their jobs in the military-industrial complex, but there will be more opportunities for them elsewhere in the economy, in particular in education and the green economy.
Well, we do have a nominee for the Secretary of so-called Defense who, for all his flaws, says he wants to reduce spending, including reducing and eliminating nuclear weapons. So maybe, but it seems we're hearing more disastrous proposals, like raising the eligibility age for Medicare. And I'm inclined to agree with groups like National Nurses United that we ought to lower the eligibility age of Medicare down to zero and put everybody in there. What would be the impact there?
I like the way you said that. The point is that if we compare our current health care system relative to, I mean, it's almost become a cliche, relative to Canada, or relative to basically all of Western Europe, those countries spend about half that we of what we do as a share of their GDP, as a share of their overall economy, and they deliver superior overall outcomes in terms of health, longer lifespans, for example, on average. So the reason is that we squander about half of our total spending on healthcare, which is about 16% of GDP. So we're spending about $3 trillion on healthcare. And about half of that, let's say $1.5 trillion, is squandered on administration, on insurance, and on excessive costs to pharmaceutical companies. Other countries just don't do that. So, yeah, if we were to move towards something like Medicare for All, what we could do is essentially drive down the cost of medical care in the country by about half.
And the impact on the federal budget and on the economy?
Well, this is where the long-term projections for medical costs are the one area where there is a serious problem, not immediately, but over time, because obviously the proportion of older people in the economy is rising. Plus, somehow the medical industry manages to heap more costs on us every year. So were we to move towards something like Medicare for All, the long-term impact on our deficit would be gigantic. Essentially, that alone would solve whatever long-term problems we have with our deficit, were we to move to something like Medicare for All.
The impact would be positive, you're saying?
Yeah, positive in that we could get at least as good, probably significantly better, healthcare outcomes at one half of what we're paying right now. And that would then be huge in terms of reducing government spending on healthcare.
In the minute we have left, I didn't get to discuss much your paper called The Agenda for Obama Part 2. What are your words of advice or demands to the new government?
Well, we did talk about it, really. You know, number one is focus on job creation. Just focus on job creation. Specifically, cut the unemployment rate in half, below 4%. And when you do that, you not only create a lot of opportunities for people all over the economy, you will dramatically reduce poverty. The paper that you cite, thank you for citing it, shows how closely tied changes in the poverty rate are to changes in the unemployment rate. So the best single thing Obama said in his inaugural speech, he's about creating jobs, middle-class jobs, and moving people out of poverty into the middle class. The best single thing he can do for both jobs for the middle class and moving people from poverty to jobs is pushing the economy toward full employment.
Sounds like a plan to me. We've been speaking with Robert Polin. He is from the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and you can go to backtofullemployment.org. Robert Polin, thanks for being on Talk Nation Radio.
It's really been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You can take action on the agenda discussed on this show at rootsaction.org. Go there now, oppose austerity, change the Medicare age to zero, reject John Brennan for the CIA, demand justice for Aaron Swartz and John Kiriakou, and make ExxonMobil pay its fair share. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. All past shows can be found at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.